Hello everyone, it's Chris Holland here. I'm sitting with this lovely man here, Robin Harford. I've been very lucky to know him for many years. In fact, we bumped into each other in a bookshop in Bath in the 1990s. And then we sort of re-met each other down here in Devon again in the early 2000s. And as some of you may know already, Robin is, well, he's quite well known in the foraging world. And yeah, he knows a lot about plants and people, and that's why I've come to speak to him today. I even heard that Country File have him listed as Britain's top forager. So I would recommend him too, because I love the stories that he tells about plants and people, and that's why I've come to talk to him today. And so, Robin, I know that...
he's nervous.
Yeah, I am nervous. Yeah. When it comes to plants, you know so much, not just about the details of what's in them, but there's loads of history and stuff like that. But when did you actually start getting into the stories of plants?
I have absolutely no idea, actually. It was never a conscious decision to become a teacher, which I still don't see myself as. I just flap my lips about plants to anyone who's prepared to hear. But I've always very much had an interest in the world at large. I'm naturally quite anarchic, so the idea of being a leader or a teacher just really doesn't compute. But hey, I find myself in this situation, don't I? Yeah. The ecosystem often has a bigger agenda for us than we even realise. That's one truism that I'm absolutely sold on. So plants and people. Ethnobotanical researcher, if I'm going to be bagged and tagged, and foraging is something that I do rather than it being a profession. I don't supply restaurants, I do it personally for myself. And what I love, or started realizing, okay, we need to backstep here. So okay. I was in digital marketing until 2004, broke down. For those of you that don't know, became a really good drug addict and alcoholic, and in order to get well, started walking my dog down the green lanes around where I lived in Devon. And didn't know what this greenness was. And I grew up in the countryside. I loved nature. It was my sanctuary to get away from horrible adults who were not very kind.
Yeah.
And I would take a plant out and go to the library and look it up, and it would be predominantly medicinal. You know, 80% of the plants were medicinal, but being a bit of a foodie, I liked the medicine side, that was fascinating, but the food was what I focused on, and I started realizing that some of the plants had been food as well. So that's what I started exploring, and I started getting the usual books out, Food for Free, by Richard Mabey, Wild Food, Roger Phillips, the usual kind of go-to books that everyone knows about. And then I just started exploring more, and the stories kind of came about themselves. I'm not a storyteller either, that's the other thing. People keep telling me I'm a storyteller. I don't tell fantasy fiction stories, but I do collate. The way my brain works is it kind of explores a universe around a subject. So you might take ground ivy, and suddenly I'm exploring medieval history, I'm exploring social history, enclosures, what was the influence on the people then, and thereby default what was the influence of our connection to plants. And I'm a vacuum for data.
And you sort of spew it out in such a lovely way as well, in this you tie all these different bits and bobs together from all over the place, because you're so widely read. It's like you've gone into this world of edible plants and just consumed as much as you can information about it, the history and the chemistry and everything. And you know, going on a walk with you, what I find funny is that in a way that we re-met partly through foraging courses, and you came along.
Took me out. I mean, let's get the story down in black and white, so to speak.
Yeah.
But when I wanted to learn about wild food plants, you were the first person to take me out. And so that was the genesis.
Yeah, I suppose so. But you were already interested.
Yeah.
And I love the way that you've drawn in so much more information. And now Now you've published like 50 notebooks on plants, yeah. And you've been self-publishing for decades, pretty much
since 1995. Not on plants back then, on privacy and counter surveillance. Nice little grey area there.
But in a way, your anarchic personality has kind of lends itself well to this kind of common sense world of plants, and it's like, this is the stuff that people should be knowing about. So, and what I love about it is that you share it so widely, and I think that's what drags people onto your course, or not you don't get dragged, they just get impelled to come.
They do. I mean, it's funny because people come on my courses thinking that we're going to talk food. And I'm into language a lot. I'm very deliberate about the kinds of words I choose. Sometimes I'm deliberately challenging and provocative, because I talk about, to meet plants, we have to break out of our monoculture thinking, the dominant culture thinking, which is, you know, if you take the word monoculture, that's normally a field that's square with one plant. You know, there's no diversity. And so they come thinking they're just going to have a talking head with facts and figures. And they do get that to a point, but only once I've made them work. And I do make people work. I mean, it's about empowering people to stop looking at the bloody authorities and the gurus and the gods who set themselves up as some expert, and realize that, you know, we exist because of plants. We've fed since we were weaned from breast or bottle. We have textures and flavors within us. You don't need me to tell you how to cook with it, even though I've got a recipe site.
Yeah.
But, you know, even still, people say, oh, can I use 1 teaspoon of honey as opposed to 2? It's like, for God's sake, just fucking take responsibility and empower yourself, and trust your response to the ecosystem, trust your response to a plant when you crush it and you smell it. You know, that's the work for me, is the re-empowering of people with their embedded traditional knowledge, that even though they don't think they've got it, they have got it.
Yeah.
Because we've all eaten. We eat every day unless we're sick or we're on you know, still in the womb. And even then we're eating what the mother's eating. It's a multifaceted way of introducing people to plants. But the food thing is just the beginning. I mean, take the word food. What does that mean? Are we talking just this, or are we talking a far deeper level of being fed on, and I don't use quasi-spiritual words, but a feeding that's in the core of our being, that nourishment we get when we go out on a crazy, mad, grey, dark, windy, wet day, that feeling we come back with, even if we haven't eaten. Feeding and eating are different things. We have been fed deeply in our core. And to me, if I can just introduce people to that aspect of what foraging for me is all about, which is restoring vital connection, that's it. And that restoration, you don't have to go to, well, this is where I'm a bit more kind of out there, I suppose I'm an outlier in this discussion, that you don't need to be in wilderness, you don't need to be in countryside, you can do it in your city park. 80% of us live in a city, and for me it's vital that the stories are told in a way, if they are indeed stories, in a way that will be relevant to the single parent in the most economically deprived part of Britain, period. If I can't do that, I haven't done my job. So that's not about watering everything down and becoming mediocre. It's about making the information and the data accessible to everybody, and therefore language is really, really, really important to do that. And I often talk about the wisdom of the gutter. You know, you'll find more wisdom on the street in the gutter than you will at the top of a mountain in a temple. People are wise. We're all wise, and we forget, we go looking for that wisdom in someone else, or anyway, I think you've made my point. And the other point is about the word gather. Oh, we're going gathering, are we? Okay, yeah, we are going gathering. So there's a communal aspect there, but we're gathering together. We're gathering plants. We gather together to celebrate, to break bread together, to recognise our commonality with each other. Yeah, so words are good. Words are really good. I suppose this is about storytelling, so they are important, aren't they?
Yeah.
But they're not stories. You see, you're a storyteller, and I don't. I just don't put myself into that same space because I don't spin folk tales or stuff like that.
Yeah. Well, there's so many different layers to storytelling. Everyone's got a story to tell, and it may be a personal story. It might be a story about a thing or a plant or, you know, how this microphone came to be here just in front of us. Or it could be, you know, the history of something, and everyone tells that in a different way. Humans are, you know, oral creatures, and so it's something that's innate in any of us. And I think if you find a sort of scene that you're happy to talk about, then that's when you can sort of tap into something that's kind of beyond you. Like there's this storyteller, or there's this information behind us that will come out through this mouth. Another mouth will say it in a different way. So, you know, I too don't see myself as a certain kind of storyteller, like one who can tell epic tales for a whole night long.
Yeah.
You know, my kind of stories are like 10, 15 minutes long. So there's lots of different ways of telling a story.
But is a story almost also trying to transmit or communicate a moral principle or an insight, or is it just a story? I mean, what?
Yeah, if you're asking,
are we about making change happen? If we're storytellers, are we about making change happen in the world, or are we just there to tickle someone's
I don't know,
heart for a moment?
Yeah, I think that's, I like that, tickle someone's heart for a moment. And as somebody said to me many years ago, that, you know, stories are a little bit like rose petals, or, you know, little bits of fruit, and sometimes they will just drop on the wayside and so that nobody will pick them up, or maybe somebody will come along and pick them and, you know, get nourishment or be fed by the story on some deep level. And, you know, each story will be listened to at a different level by each different person. Like this weekend I was asked to do a little bit of storytelling, so I chose a particular story which, you know, often I will tell to sort of 8 to 12 year olds, because it's a story about the seasons, it's about letting go, it's about sharing your gifts and realizing what your gifts are and being sort of proud of them, and the kind of regenerative cycle of the year. But, you know, an 8 to 12 year old wouldn't get that on that level of the story. Underneath it, and then underneath that again, there's different layers to it. So yeah, I think stories land in different ways, like different seeds will need different soils to land in, and to be fertile in that way.
You see, my granddaughter, who's coming into being 8 in a month, she's what I call a storyteller, because she spins stories about wild witches and berries and flowers and makes potions. And so it's more, I suppose, to me, in my kind of understanding of stories, is that they're more imaginary. They're more imagination.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Just as many different types of plants.
Like you say, yeah.
Different types of stories.
Yeah.
I would say.
Yeah.
One of the things I wanted to get your thoughts on is that at the moment with climate change and as our biomes are changing as well, and plants are beginning to grow in different places, and with the way that humans have moved around, we've kind of shuffled, in a way, shuffled the deck in terms of the plants and where they've been growing naturally. And some of them are sort of popping up here and there and everywhere where they haven't been growing for hundreds or thousands of ever grown.
Yeah.
And so it's like invasive species is one of the words that people use. And
oh, those bloody immigrants, you mean?
Well, like,
and
exactly,
people use that language.
Yeah, they do.
The Daily Mail headlines.
What, on the plants?
Yeah, absolutely. Immigrant, not bloody immigrants, but immigrant plants.
Yeah.
I mean, this right-wing fascist construct percolates through so many different areas that we project it onto a plant.
Yeah.
Something or the other. Oh, can't have the other here. It's not native.
So what do you
not
think
British.
About that?
What do I think about it? I bloody love invasive species. people challenge me off on my walks, but especially when I start talking about new arrivals like Himalayan balsam and Japanese knotweed. As they go, but it crowds out all the native plants, and it's like, okay, let's just stop right here. What on earth do you mean by native? What do you mean by native? What do you mean by indigenous plants? At the end of the last ice age, from my understanding, and someone may completely blow this out of the water, but from my understanding, there were 150 so-called indigenous plants. Well, Stace brought out his new flora, his new wildflower flora. So I found out the problems, and they went, there's 5,000. So we had 150 of our so-called indigenous native species, and we now got 5,000. Well, everything is a blow-in. Everything is an immigrant, or a migrant has come here somehow. So what do I think of invasive species? I really like them. I spotted Himalayan balsam a long time, over a decade ago, and started pondering, why are you here? Because my plant teacher mentor, Frank Cook, that Chris introduced me to, always said, if there's a plant growing around humans in profusion, you need to be paying attention to it. And you need to be figuring out what is the relationship that's going on between the plant and the human and the human and the plant. And so we ponder this. And I spoke to a lot of kind of far more academically focused ecologists, etc. And the phrase that kept coming out is second-guessing climate change. It's like, what? What do you... Blimey, that's interesting. Okay. So this plant comes in, Himalayan balsam, and I'm researching it, and the seeds are delicious. They taste like walnuts. And in India, in the Himalayas, they use a... they extract an oil from it, and you know, there's no other bit of the plant you could the plant you can eat in the ethnobotanical record that I've found. Again, someone may be able to qualify that, but I certainly haven't found any other part of it, which is important because it's seriously high in calcium oxalates, and you don't want to be eating the rest of it. I'm just making health and safety, health and safety, as we call it. And so why is this plant here? And then slowly, the kind of the change in understanding of ecology and conservation as well, and this idea that we need to get rid of the foreigner, get them out, we want only British plants, was indicative to an imperialist, colonialist conservation culture that is still going on, especially with people like WWF, and I hope you're listening here, genocidal maniacs. That's my latest beef. Listen to read Stephen Corry, who's the CEO of Survival International, if you really want to know what's going on with these conservation NGOs, because it's a dark, dark story. Anyway, that aside, I hope you keep that bit in,
because
do need to know this. What's this plant doing? What's its function? So Stephen Harrod Booner, who wrote the great plantsman and plant walker, you know, he talks about this, everything has an ecological function. So what's the ecological function of Himalayan balsam in the British Isles? And slowly what's come out is Fred Pearce in his book The New Wild, that suddenly, you know, this man who's an ecological journalist, investigative journalist, hated invasive species for years, and then wrote this book The New Wild, which completely flipped his brain, because and he goes on hard data. This isn't like plant spirit medicine stuff. This is hard data. What's the data, the science saying? And he's completely reversed his belief system in that actually invasive species are here for a reason. And something like Himalayan balsam only occurs where humans have disturbed the soil. So we've been pointing at the plant going, you bad plant. And we got three fingers pointing at us.
Yeah.
And not realizing that we possibly could be the reason, and that what this plant is doing is actually healing soil, right? Cleaning soil up. And it comes from an interesting climate. So I've got a friend, Pete Yeo, who runs Future Flora, and he's massively geeking out on invasive species and studying them. And he's made a really interesting correlation between those plants that are defined as invasive and the climates that they've come from. So he reckoned, and it is purely hypothesis this, so we're just observing it, but it's an interesting one that it kind of is correlating with my work and many other people's work, that these plants are coming from cultures whose climate, the UK climate, is possibly expected to be in the next 10 to 20 years. So this idea that somehow we got to go back to the native. It's like the rewilders, and I'm not saying all rewilders do this, but there's a big element of them. And Pete and I actually did an interview on why the balsam bashers might be wrong. And we'd received an email from one of the rewilding organisations when Pete had asked them about, well, what are you doing about invasives? And their policy was genocide, get rid of them. No, they're not native. No, it's not back in this pristine wilderness. You know, with the courtesy of that racist John Muir. I'm being controversial, aren't I? Mm. But I'm basically spitting out at what I believe. John Muir, you know, who took these beautiful images of pristine wilderness. And it's even written in one of his diaries, if you go and read it, that he had to wait until those foul, stinking beasts had got out of the frame. Yeah, and when I say that to people, people go, oh, he means buffaloes. It's like, no, he meant Native Americans. Nice guy. And so we have this belief, this worldview in the ecology, the conservation, the sustainability movement, that somehow we need pristine wilderness. And sorry, chaps and chapettes, nature's on a continuum. Yeah. And we're shopping and the rest of the ecosystem is adapting. So,
Over-shopping. Demonize.
We are over-shopping, darling, yes. Yes, how many pairs of shoes and trousers do you need?
Yeah.
It's a curious old world at the moment.
I
love invasive species, and some people have observed that when they've cleaned up the soil, they actually die back, something like Himalayan balsam.
And that's what I've been noticing recently as well.
There you go.
And the bees love them.
Yeah, they do.
It's really important to have some late forage for them, and there's not much else around.
And cattle love them.
Yeah, do they?
Munch it, and they're big carbon sink, apparently. I think. Anyway, I'm moving off something I don't actually know about.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's stick to things that we do know about, or think we know about, anyway.
Think being the operative word.
One of the other questions I wanted to ask you about is that in terms of being... I know you don't call yourself a storyteller, but the power to tell a story, when it really is tripping off your tongue, then what kind of tips might you give to a budding storyteller or an outdoor educator or a parent who would like to feel a bit more confident about speaking up about something, a story of something? What tip could you give them?
Imbue the tale with your own experience. Don't invalidate your experience, however simple it might be. It might just be picking a bramble fruit, blackberry, and making jam with it one day. But there's, I love Buna's words in his book Ensouling Language. He says words and language are meant to imbue a feeling sense, otherwise they stay up in the head.
Yeah,
and that doesn't serve anybody. And so if you're talking bramble to children or adults or angels, whoever, pull in your own experience of it, not from a fact base. This is where it gets more poetic, I suppose. But from that feeling sense, what did it feel like, that first fruit of the summer, as you bit into it and reveled in it and just could feel it filling your bones? So personal, I pull a lot of my own personal story, life story, and interweave it with plants.
Great.
I think, put you in it.
Yeah.
Put you in it, because it's real, it's authentic, it gives quality and depth to the story. It's not, you're not dissociated from, oh, this is bramble, and did you know you can make tea with the leaf if you ferment it? And that's nice, that's great, but bring it in, fold it into your own dream, your own experience, and then that becomes coloured and unique.
Yeah.
And so we can all take the same facts of a plant, because if we're trying to teach people how to use a plant in a specific way, but we fill it up with ourselves, and that's, I think, really vital. Because and don't try and be a bloody expert, for God's sake. Forget the scripts of being an authority. I mean, I'm an old punk, so that's why I bang on about it, because we've all become, pull them into the plant. Don't pick a plant and hand it to them. Encourage self-responsibility, encourage empowerment, encourage personal engagement, and don't give them any of the facts initially. call the group out, ask them, what are they getting? What's the experience? What does it smell like? What does it remind them of? What does it taste like to them?
Because that's where the connection starts, isn't it?
That is the point.
And that's what we want.
Baseline. And if that's all that they go away with, you've set them off on a life journey that many of them will never return from. Because the world will grab their heart.
Yes, the plants will get them.
Yeah, they're bloody
their
right, they will.
The roots will get in there. Oh, great. And another thing is that two more things. One is plant for this time of year. It's the end of the year. It's October, end of October, beginning of November today. So traditionally this was a sort of Beltane festival time when the spirit of the land was kind of going back into the land.
Beltane or Samhain?
Samhain, sorry, Beltane's in May. I'm just being nervous on camera. Hi. Yeah, so Samhain and spirit of the land going into the ground, but there's still a few plants around.
Yeah, there are.
So one is like, what plant are you excited about at the moment, if you could choose one? And also tell people how they can get in contact with you, and you know, what things have you published recently that you'd like people to know about?
Yeah, I got asked this question yesterday. Do I have a favourite plant? Now, I always find it a really difficult question to answer, but I suppose if I'm kind of like, you know, who's hanging out in the corner, a bit like, you know, he's got a roll up and a pint and a flat cap, and they're just over there going, "Oi, Rob, pay attention, I'm over here."
Yeah.
Got to be ground ivy.
Uh-huh, yeah, you mentioned ground ivy.
Yeah, it's just I'm a smelly person. I just like smelly plants. I'm very, olfactory through my nose. I identify plants through their smell. I encourage you to do that. Just as every human has a unique smell, I believe, I have no evidence for this, but I believe every plant has a unique smell.
Yeah.
And it's only by picking, crushing and smelling them, and only if they're edible, children, do you eat them. But it's the smell. I learned of a tribe in Africa actually this year in one of the anthropological papers that their vocabulary is something like 40-50 times greater for describing the sense of smell than it is colour.
Wow.
Yeah, which is pretty bonkers. Because in the West, we got this thing that, you know, we came up off all fours, and when we stood up, eyes were the thing. That's the medium that we learn the world through. And honest, I've done a bit of travelling into forests with indigenous cultures, and it's like, nah, it's bollocks. All the senses, and smell is really, really crucial. So ground ivy, I love, because it's really pongy.
Yeah, it's one of the first herbs I got into as well.
Love it. I don't know what it is about it, but I go with that. I want to make a drink with it. So, you know, past life, can't drink alcohol as a result. So in spring, it's in the diary, go make a syrup, a cordial with it, because I think it will be quite cool. And it's got such a history.
It has, hasn't it?
I mean, it's like...
Ale hoof.
Pre-group, I mean, do you want the story?
Go on, if you want to share a bit. How long have we got?
Blimey, I don't know. Let's make it short.
Yeah.
So, you know, before hops came into our drinking culture, which was around the 1600s, I think, prior to that, we clarified and add bitterness to our hedgerow plants, our ales. They were known as Groot ales, G-R-U-I-T.
Groot.
And ale hoof, ground ivy, Glaucoma hedera, whatever, was put into the brew. So we had this time of in our culture where, because it was medieval times, you know, men and women wore bright colours, rings on fingers, bells on toes, we just danced around. 200 festival and feast days in a year of 365 days. That's party central, man. Merry England. MERRIE, is like, the bell would only sound once for prayer at 6 p.m. or midday. You know, I mean, time was like not really part of our, you know, clock ticking. Sorry, off 30 seconds late for work, kind of. It was not on the cards. Yeah, it was a different way.
It's pre-time then, in a way, pre-clock as well.
It was pre-clock.
In the countryside.
Yeah. And so we drank these ales for our celebrations, and they were quite weak, I would assume. And then you kind of get the Puritans coming in with their with their hops, you know, and it's like anti-sex, brewer's droop. That's where it comes from. It's hops. It's soporific.
Yeah.
It keeps the peasants and the plebs at bay, because we were quite a rebellious lot. We, you know, we kept our masters in check back then. Well, now we go on the streets and beg them to make change. Now, we made them make change. Controversial again.
Yeah, I know.
And so it dampened our fire. And we could get a skinful and turn up the next day, you know, to work.
Mm.
And then we wore black. We took off our colours, took off our bells. They banned singing and song. The Birchley banned Christmas, the Puritans. And we wore black and became shameful of our bodies and shameful of our minds. And then we jumped forwards to when black Indian tea came into this culture, which was really expensive. So the aristocracy would get their servants to go and buy the tea. They'd make the tea. They'd strain the tea out. Servants would take the tea leaves back to the tea merchant.
Mm-hmm.
Round two, second-hand tea. Sell it to the people who weren't aristocrats and didn't have servants, but were definitely trying to aspire to that level.
Yeah.
They'd have to make their own blooming tea. They'd have to strain their own tea, and they'd have to hobble back down to the tea merchant to sell the tea back to him. Third-hand tea. Now, working-class people ain't thick, right? And the tea merchant knew that. He knew that if he tried to sell third-hand wood tea to the masses, yeah, you might have a bit of a problem.
Certainly.
Might not have a shop,
yeah,
at the end. A little bit of rumpus going on.
Yeah.
And so he was ingenious, and he gathered ground ivy leaves and he dried them and he mixed it in with the tea, and it was sold as gill tea or gilly tea.
Uh-huh.
So, which is really refreshing. I mean, ground ivy leaf as a tea is really rehydrating.
Yeah,
you can just feel it soaking in through your body. And then jump forward to the modern day.
Yeah.
Well, where do we work with this? We've got all the lovely Michelin chefs and all that. And I met a chef in Dorset, and he was bigging up ground ivy leaf one day, and I just spat it out. I said, well, what do you use it? And he went, steak and ale pie. Ah. So from the Middle Ages, we grew ales, we got to black India tea, to using it with steak and ale pie, because there is that inference. And it is, it's like you could make wild bouquet garnis with it, you know, mixed herbs, just dried. And yeah, and you did something with a load of kids, didn't you? Tempering it, like
tempering
1,000 leaves, and which one won?
Ground ivy and nettles were the favourites.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
So you're going to have to look for it, right?
Mm.
Get multiple
get
books
and look around.
Yeah, in the woods
somewhere.
And just smell the woods, yeah? Forget standing back. Get in and crush and smell everything.
Because all the smells are much lower down, aren't they?
Totally.
They don't really get up to here, so it's...
Yeah.
It's good to get on your hands and knees and have a sniff around.
It is. Get an eyeglass is a little fun thing you can do with the kids and everybody else. Get a little eyeglass, a loop, botanical loop, and spend 45 minutes going across a woodland floor just using the eyeglass.
Yeah.
And you'll be amazed how many ticks there are.
Oh, yes, that's another thing. We won't go onto that one at the moment.
No.
Yes.
But that one, that kind of reframes your brain
to
be absorbed and consumed by wildness that is the dandelion cracking through the pavement as you walk down London, you know?
Yeah.
Ain't going to stop the greenness.
Yeah, it's coming back. I love that graffiti artist. I can't remember her name, who draws the plants, wild plants and things.
Yeah.
So tell us about your notebooks and, you know, the stuff that people can get off you. What's happening?
So I have a information site called Eat Weeds. .co.uk, EATWEEDS.co.uk, and you'll find everything that I do, find my courses there, find my notebooks there. There's a ton of free content there if you basically haven't got a bean to rub together. But please support the independent creative artist, because we also have bills to pay, and I don't do funding, and I don't beg corporations for cash. It's all self-generated.
Yeah, awesome.
And yeah, tons and tons of recipes. But like I say, you know, trust your senses. Use the recipes just as a springboard. If you really can't, just pause, crush, smell, or nibble, and then just see what it reminds you of, and go with that inspiration. Because I didn't when I first started, and now it's about 85% hit rate. Trust yourself, as the old Crass, the anarcho punk band, said, be your own authority.
Yeah, absolutely. Remember that first time I gave you it wasn't pine cone, it was a pine cone bud.
Yeah.
On the
Blimey,
coastal
I'd forgotten
path
about that.
And you know, getting into your senses, and I just remember you sort of going,
Like, what is this?
I got completely walloped. Hmm. Actually, I don't do plant spirit medicine, but if I did, then this thing
was a moment,
smacked
was it?
Me. Big style. I literally went over. Yeah. It was such it was like a charge coming in. I'd forgotten all that. But I remember it now, very visibly. Yeah, that's like, blimey.
Hey, anyway, I hope you have some great experiences out there with plants, and thank you so much for your time this morning in this place, a little bit down the River Ex. We've had the mower, we've had the robin, blackbirds, and all kinds of stuff.
The train, the plane.
Yeah.
I haven't had an automobile.
No, not yet.
But we are on the edge of a city, so that's okay.
Which is, edges are good. Edges are good for
edges
plants.
Edges are good.
Yeah.
Very much.
Anyway, till the next time.
Yeah.
Thank you, Robin.
Cheers, mate.
Awesome.